there's a dark wave of hostility that's about to crash onto the church. And many people are not ready. And this is why the sense of urgency is there, is that if we're not ready, then I think many people are going to get knocked out.
Welcome to the Christian Emergency Podcast, a podcast for Christians spooked by the growing hostility in the culture today. We will tackle a range of topics from current events, persecution, missions, and what it means to be the church. You will gain valuable insights from those experienced working with persecuted Christians around the world, insights we all need to chew on in these strange days. Together, may we help the church stand. Hey everyone, and welcome to the Christian Emergency Podcast. I'm Andy Coleman, your host, and I'm excited for today's episode. It's going to be informative to you from a variety of perspectives. In particular, we're joined by a guest who can speak from a mature Christian perspective, from a missions perspective, and even from a persecution perspective. We are joined by Pastor Andrew Brunson. If you're not already familiar with him, he is an American Christian and American missionary who served for roughly 25 years in Turkey, and he was even in prison for those last 2 years between October 2016 and October 2018. So he's been very experienced on the missions field in a compelling area, trying to work and see the kingdom advance, and also paying a price, being willing to pay a price and going through some trials because of that faith. The insights he will share, I'm confident, will bless you, inform you, and help you as you chart out your next steps. Just be sure to listen to the end. And with that, I want to welcome Andrew Brunson.
Hi. Thanks.
I shared a little bit about your background really fast, Andrew. Would you just tell us a little bit more about yourself and your ministry?
Well, I grew up as a missionary kid in Mexico. My wife grew up as a missionary kid in France. We met in college, and then we went to Turkey. Turkey is the largest unevangelized country in the world. It's Muslim. Most Turks have never met a Christian in their life. Most Turkish cities do not have any church or pastor or missionary living in their city. So it's the largest unevangelized country in the world. So we were involved in several church plants over the years, also starting a house of prayer. And when the civil war in Syria heated up, a lot of refugees came into Turkey, so we were involved in reaching out to them. It's a refugee church that was started, and just doing outreach to them, trying to, with humanitarian aid, but also especially to give them the gospel, people who were formerly inaccessible, now coming into a place where we could reach them. And so, and also involved in training, doing that for a number of years until 2000, well, for 23 years. And then suddenly we were arrested. There was an order to deport us, but they didn't get around to deporting us. They let Noreen go after 2 weeks. And for me, they kept me for 2 years.
Wow. So there's going to be a lot that you're going to be able to shed light on from that experience, 2 years in a Turkish prison. Before we dig more into that, I love that you were describing some of the kingdom efforts in Syria, the kingdom efforts in Turkey, and shedding some light on the situation in Turkey. That's so good for our audience, just for us to understand the state of the global climate that we're in. Would you be able just to talk a little bit more about the Turkish church? So it may not be very large, but the indigenous Turkish church is scattered. There's many cities, like you described, without a church, but it is there. Would you just be able to tell us a little bit more about them, our spiritual brothers and sisters in Turkey?
Yeah, so Turkey was, you could say, it's the land of the Bible in many ways. Abraham lived there for a time, going that far back. But especially the New Testament, much of the New Testament, most of the New Testament was written for or by people living in what is modern day Turkey. The church was very strong there. We lived in Izmir, which is ancient Smyrna, which people recognize as one of the seven churches of Revelation. And this was an apostolic center, very strong church, majority Christian in the first centuries, of the church, became majority Christian. Islam came in and pretty much engulfed it. And this is one reason why when we talk about persecution, people often say, well, persecution is good for the church and look at the church in China, you know, it's grown under persecution. And I say, well, yes, this, that is true, except when it isn't. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the church grows under persecution, and sometimes the persecution is so intense and of such a character that it wipes out the church. And so there used to actually be many millions of believers throughout the whole Middle East and North Africa, extending all the way to China. And most of those are gone now because of the intense persecution. Anyway, the Turks are all Muslim as part of their identity. To be a Turk is to be a Muslim. This is the president of Turkey himself said that in relation to my case, which was very much in the news and which he was the one directing. The president was the one deciding what would happen with me. And so for a Turk to turn to Jesus is a very big deal. And many people in Turkey would consider them traitors, which they're not, but that's how they would be viewed. The church in Turkey now has maybe 7,000 to 8,000 believers in it. Well, I mean, Turks, people from a Turkish background who have come out of Islam. So 7,000 to 8,000 out of 85 million. So that gives you an idea of the ratio. But up until now, it has been relatively high freedom, low interest. So even though it's a Muslim country, there was relative to the, in comparison to the countries around us, there was more freedom for the gospel, but there was very little interest. And now there's a lot of oppression going on in the name. It's all being done in the name of Islam. And so there's, you could say there's less freedom, but there's increasing interest. Many young people are reacting toward this oppressive Islam, and they're walking in larger numbers than ever before, is what we're told, into churches saying, I don't know what I am. I don't know if I'm a deist or an atheist, but I know that I don't want to be a Muslim anymore. So this is happening more and more. We believe God had showed us that there will be a great harvest in Turkey, and he'd actually spoken to me very directly and said, prepare for harvest. And that's a different story, but I see that the harvest hasn't started, but every time the Lord showed us something about harvest, it was also in difficult circumstances. So even as there will be a powerful move of God in Turkey, but it's going to come amidst great difficulty. And actually, as I looked at my imprisonment, you know, when I was first arrested, I thought, wait, you know, God has told me to prepare for harvest. You know, you can't kick me out of the country. You can't deport me. I have an assignment here. Mm-hmm. You know, how can I do this if I'm out of the country? But then as I languished in prison, as my imprisonment dragged on, God started a worldwide prayer movement that was clearly directed by God, sustained by him, driven by him, because there hasn't been a similar prayer movement focused on one person with so many people around the world praying for one person. This is what church historians mm-hmm. have told me, that was unprecedented. And so I became one of the most prayed for people in the world. And clearly this wasn't about me. You know, God doesn't need that many people to pray for me, but I became a lightning rod that was drawing in prayer that was then, you know, being dispersed into that country. And I believe that is, so I came to see that my imprisonment was actually serving the original assignment, which was to prepare for harvest. I was just sitting in prison, kind of helpless and not doing anything except for trying to hang on. And God was using that to prepare for harvest there.
Well, God certainly magnifies his power in our weakness. And sure, I mean, even if you're sitting in a prison cell passively there, but that's marshaling all this prayer. Yeah, that's very significant. And I think it is exciting to think about harvest coming to the lands of Turkey again. And, you know, you served there for 23 years before your imprisonment, and you were laying seed, you were encouraging and nurturing this small church. And harvest comes later. Maybe somebody else gets the harvest, but you got the joy of serving him in that beautiful land, beautiful people. Really a neat spot to serve in, but it'll be so exciting to see these souls come to Christ out of darkness, even if pressures are increasing. We see that. We saw it in China. We saw it in Iran, where there was what you might describe as a baby church with some missionaries helping, but pressures really ticked up and a lot of those missionaries were forced out. And this baby church that looked like it was doomed ends up thriving and growing. And yeah, so you touched on a lot of stuff there. You even touched about the fact that we should be more sober when we sometimes talk about persecution, not less cavalier when we're describing the pressure that some of our brothers and sisters in different parts of the world endure and overcome. But persecution can have a devastating effect. The quote, "The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church," was said, I believe, by Tertullian, who was a North African Christian. And not long after those words were spoken, North Africa was overwhelmed by Islam, and today is a vast majority Muslim area. So those are wise words. But you know, for any of our listeners that are just now opening up your mind to the fact that you have Turkish brothers and sisters, and that there's churches there, even if they're few in number, but they're reflecting God's light in that land, well, I would just encourage you to be intentional and pray about that and lift that up and get more informed about what's going on there, what God is doing there. So Pastor Brunson, you spent 2 years of your life in prison. Would you just start to unpack that for what that must have been like for somebody that was not expecting to see the inside of a Turkish prison cell?
Yeah. So first, please call me Andrew. Nobody calls me Pastor Brunson. It was something that happened because you know, we were missionaries, and as this came out more and more in media, the word missionary is very wrongly understood in much of the Muslim world. And so they decided to call me pastor instead. So anyway, I go by Andrew. That's my
okay.
Yeah, so I would characterize myself as having been a relatively toughened missionary because we had been involved in a number of open church plants that were out in public. So it was a very open ministry, a number of church plants in unchurched cities. So this drew attention. And if you care about being popular, then you don't start churches in a Muslim country. So, you know, there were decisions my wife and I had made to deal with risk. We had a number of bomb threats and death threats over the years. One time our church was attacked by a gunman. I was shot at and had to tackle the gunman and hold him until police arrived. So there was a measure of risk. There was also risk when we were on the Syrian-Turkish border. There was still a lot of fighting going on between ISIS and the Kurds. And as foreigners, we weren't somewhere there. So I'm saying that just to underline that we had counted the cost to some, perhaps naively, and had persevered with some risk. And it's not unique to us. Anybody who's involved in public ministry the way we were would have the same level of risk, perhaps. So I mentioned that because if someone had said to me, Andrew, you're going to spend time in a Turkish prison, I would have been afraid, but I also would have had a sense of bravado. I would have thought, you know, some of my heroes have suffered imprisonment, my Christian heroes, heroes of the faith, and they did well. And they had a sense of joy and strength in the midst of it and of God's presence. And it's going to be difficult, but it's going to be good. And I would say this based on my reading of biographies and also just on my personal walk with God, having seen him intervene, having experienced his presence many times. And so because of this, I was very surprised when I did end up in prison and I started to break very quickly. So let me first say, I spent 2 years in prison, but I didn't know it would be 2 years. The Turkish government wanted 3 life sentences for me in solitary confinement with no possibility of parole. So as far as I knew, this was very possible that I end up never leaving prison and end up dying there, never seeing my children and being with my wife again. So this was the uncertainty that I was living with, the fear that this, you know, could be the end of, you know, seeing my family. Mm-hmm. And really the end of my life there. So, and I didn't know until the day that I was released that I was going to be released. So it was 2 full years of this uncertainty and this great threat hanging over me. There was a lot of fear. So all of these things are normal. The uncertainty, the fear, because of the fear, just being very practical about this, it causes a great release of stress hormones in the body, cortisol and adrenaline. And over time, this, well, it keeps me from sleeping because I would start to fall asleep and then jerk awake with a surge of adrenaline. Mm-hmm. So I was sleeping maybe 2 or 3 hours total a day. And over time, my body wore out and this led to a series of panic attacks. And if you have despair, and panic. That is a very deadly combination. I was also isolated, well, by culture, language, although I spoke Turkish, but by my life experience, nationality. I was the only American in the cells that I was kept. And I was the only Christian, so especially isolation in my faith. So I was always kept with, I was kept in solitary confinement for a time. That has its own difficulties. That's where I started to break. But then I was put into a cell built for 8 people that had 22 of us crammed in there. They were all very strong Muslims. It was like being in a Muslim house of prayer. There was every hour of the day, literally day and night, 24/7, there was some kind of Muslim worship, 5 times a day prayer, which they did in shifts because there wasn't enough room for them all to do it together, or the chanting of the Quran or Quran and Bible studies or individual prayers. So it was, and we never left the cell. So it's nonstop, 24/7 in a crowded cell. And I was alone in my faith. I had a lot of doubts, questions, and confusion, and I didn't have any other believer with me to encourage me, pray with me, or correct my wrong ways of thinking. The only Christian I had any interaction with for 2 years was with my wife when she was allowed to visit me. And so this isolation in my faith and the uncertainty and the fear was enough to break me. But what really took me into spiritual crisis, the rest would have been enough to break me anyway, I realize. But the spiritual crisis came especially from God not meeting my expectations. I lost all sense of his presence and of his voice for 2 years. And so I felt abandoned by him. I had been teaching on the Father heart of God, the kind, generous, gentle Father. And suddenly where is my loving Father? I just don't see him. And so this took me into questioning his existence, which was, maybe some of your listeners will think, how can that be? Well, I had the same question. How is that possible after so many years of serving God, you know, that I could question his existence? Eventually, I said, no, he must. Actually, I don't know how much detail you want, but I had to make a list of truths to repeat, to discipline myself to repeat several times a day, just to try to center myself on truth. And the first one was, God, I believe you exist and that you're involved in my life. And I had to repeat this to myself multiple times a day, especially in the first months. That I was reduced to that basic, very basic affirmation.
Yeah.
And then I eventually said, okay, God, you must exist. But then I questioned his character. I accused him, you know, are you truly loving, faithful, good? And I don't know that you're always truthful. So, and there are stories around why I had these questions, but essentially it took me into spiritual crisis. I became suicidal, and this was suffocating my relationship with God.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of suffering, a lot of internal turmoil.
Can I say something here? You know that I thought I was the weakest person in the world. And after I got out of prison, I found out that my experience was not that unusual. So we hear about some very strong people who go through difficulties, and maybe they really don't struggle, but maybe some of the biographies don't tell the full story. And I know of at least 2 people whose biographies I'd read, prison biographies, who, when I talked with them, I have found out that they didn't talk about their struggle, and they actually had a much more difficult time than the biographies tell us about. So in a sense, it was an unrealistic expectation. And I had no sense. I didn't have a sense of grace. I had grace, but when I look back on it, I see it, but it was an unfelt grace. And I've come to see grace is not an anesthetic.
Yeah.
You know, I still could feel the pain and the loss and the grief. And yet God continues to sustain me, but it feels like it's only barely enough. The first years of the year breaking, and I usually focus on the second year, which is the rebuilding, because I don't have a story of just doom and how horrible it was. No, it was really difficult, but there was a rebuilding process where God took me in my weakness and brokenness, and basically, well, I was very much involved in it.
Yeah.
We worked together on it, but where the relationship, the friendship was restored, and I came out stronger than I went in.
Well, listening to you, it almost sounds like I'm hearing about somebody going off to the military and hitting boot camp and getting broken down, and then in the later stages of that experience being built back up into a soldier. But I also just wanted to touch on real quick, one of the reasons why I think your testimony is such a transparent and honest testimony is that it can speak to other people. I think frustration occurs when our expectations go unmet. And if we have unrealistic expectations of trials, then it's all going to be grandiose and glorious without suffering, without intense suffering, and even real turmoil that can throw us when we do experience it, when darkness hits us. So to learn from others who have suffered in an acute way, but were able to cling to God, and God obviously carried them, I think that's very helpful for us just to think through now, because I do feel that pressures are building for Christians around the world. We need more testimonies like this, more people who have been pathfinders of a form where we can learn from their example and also better shape our expectations so that we don't get frustrated, we don't get blindsided when we get hit later on down the road.
Actually, you brought up pressure coming, and this is one of the, we are still involved primarily, our hearts, we still are missionaries, we still are focused on the Muslim world, but I do have a sense of assignment in the States as well, which is to prepare people to stand. And since coming back to the States, I have felt a real urgency that there is a, well, what I usually say is there's a dark wave of hostility that's about to crash onto the church. And many people are not ready. And this is why the sense of urgency is there, is that if we're not ready, then I think many people are going to get knocked out.
Mm-hmm.
You look at, you know, Jesus, whenever he talks about persecution, he also warns about the dangers, because not everyone makes it through. It is dangerous. And this is one of the things that I try to underline in sounding an alarm, is that, as I already mentioned, for myself, that I had this sense of bravado, or you said a cavalier way of looking at persecution, that it can be more difficult than we think. And I know this now from my own experience, because I almost got knocked out.
Mm-hmm.
I think of, you know, I met a Chinese leader who was one of the most wanted men in China. He spent time in prison several times, was tortured terribly, and he made it through. He's very strong, but his wife divorced him and she left the faith. And so you have people facing the same persecution or the environment of persecution with very different responses. And so I don't want people to live in fear of, you know, it's not healthy to think of all the terrible things that can happen to you. That's not what I'm suggesting, as much as saying we need to be sober-minded and discern the times we live in and what is coming our way, and prepare our hearts so that we are able to stand. And if people think this is, oh, persecution is just going to make us strong, well, it will purify the church, you know, because if there's a price, you know, to our faith, then only those who are willing to pay it will stay. But there are many people who could be knocked out simply because we don't prepare them. And so my heart is for the shepherds, you know, for pastors,
yeah,
even parents, grandparents, anyone who has people they're responsible for, is to say the sheep are in danger.
Yes,
there is danger. And as a shepherd, you've been entrusted with caring for sheep. And so you need to prepare them.
Well, we at the Christian Emergency Alliance, we have several people who have spent many years serving and ministering in difficult countries of the world, but we share the same hearts. We're concerned too that some of the patterns we saw in tough places overseas are starting to emerge more and more in places where it's less common. And there was a lot of people, a lot of Christians that were ill prepared in our estimation for what was coming down the pike. So that's why we're doing what we're doing. That's why we continue to try to serve those who are under pressure wherever they find themselves and get conversations and perspectives like yours out there.
We will return to the podcast momentarily, but first, a word from our sponsor. Being a Christian today can be hard. This is true if you live in a heavily persecuted country like Iran, or areas where cultural pressures against Christians are growing fast, like America and Europe. Fortunately, none of us have to stand alone. We are part of a giant body, one huge spiritual family that spans the globe. That is the church. The Christian Emergency Alliance is committed to helping the church stand, regardless of the pressures to come. As a 501c3 nonprofit, the Christian Emergency Alliance strives to help our spiritual family when persecution hits. We also strengthen the church by supporting ministry that makes Christ famous, defends biblical truth, and prepares fellow believers for challenges ahead. You have the opportunity to make a huge impact in this work today. Become a monthly financial ally of the Christian Emergency Alliance by signing up at christianemergency.com. Your support of $25 a month or a gift in any amount will bless those who need help in these darkening days. Help the church stand today, tomorrow, and in the days to come. Register today at www.christianemergency.com. And now, back to the show.
As you were rebuilding in that second year, and you've really been shaken, you've really suffered, but you're starting to be rebuilt. God is moving, and you are implementing some disciplines in your cell. I've heard you talk before about learning to flex your surrender muscle, your perseverance muscle. Did that occur during that second year? And if so, could you talk to that a little bit?
Yeah. So the truth is that during the entire time, including the time of great breaking, I knew what victory would look like for me. I just didn't want to think about it, and I was very weak and couldn't push toward it. But I knew that it was a matter of, there was a question of surrendering, that maybe this is what I was going to be facing for years or the rest of my life. One thing that drove it home to me was a reading in Philippians where Paul talks about Timothy, and he's saying that many people serve their own. Well, he says everyone serves their own purposes and not, or their own interests, seeks their own interests and not the interests of Christ. And that really drove into my heart. And I actually started to cry because I thought, this is me. My interest is to be with my wife, to be with my children again. That's what I want. But what if the interests of Jesus are best served by my remaining in prison? And I could not embrace prison. I could never bring myself to say, yes, I'm going to embrace this. But I knew that I could embrace serving the interests of Jesus, which could include prison. So that became, in my second year, a daily battle. I say from the beginning, I knew that this is what I needed to do. But what would happen is I would crawl up to the point of surrender. You can see it on the mountaintop, maybe up where the cross is. Go up, crawl up there and say, okay, not my will, but yours be done. If this is what you have for me, then I must submit. But then, and I'd get to that point of surrender, and then something would happen and knock me down. My situation would become worse. And then I'm just incapacitated for a time, and then I start that long crawl up to that place again, and then get knocked down again. So all along, there were moments of that kind of victory of surrender, but there were long gaps between them. In my second year, a main difference is that I started doing this much more often, and it was almost a daily thing where, you know, I wake up in the morning with that fear and dread, and I start to fight. I know what my goal is. I'm going to get to the point today where I say, I embrace serving your purposes, even if it means prison. And usually I would get there, and then I'd have a measure of peace at night. I want to emphasize, not as much as you would expect, you know, as I said, grace was not an anesthetic for me. But then I'd wake up the next morning with the same fear and dread, and I have to start that battle over again. And I did that day after day after day. So there's something about flexing, as I said, that surrender muscle. Over time, it becomes easier to do, more of an inclination of an instinct in me to do. And this is one of the things that I say I came out stronger than I went in. Yeah, I came out stronger because of that surrender, flexing of that surrender muscle. You know, actually, I recorded a video series, and I'd like to recommend that to your listeners. It's at FRC, that's Family Research Council, frc.org/prepare-to-stand. There are 7 videos where I kind of talk about, I think one of the purposes God had for my imprisonment is that I break thoroughly, repeatedly, deeply, as I did. And that then in my aloneness, in my isolation, and in my weakness and brokenness, I had to find ways to strengthen myself. There was nobody else there to do that for me. And so I had to find ways to strengthen myself so that I could remain faithful. And especially in the second year, there were a number of things that I did that helped to strengthen me and change my perspective and kept me faithful. And I think those things are transferable. And so I think one of the purposes God had in that, apart from what he was doing in my heart, was that I'd be able to be positioned to help other people who are going to go through difficult times. Yep. And so the video series, they're short videos, they're 15 to 17 minutes long, intended to be for small groups, for Sunday school, so you can look at a video and then discuss it. And there I go through, what are some of the steps that we can take? Mm-hmm. So some of what I'm saying now is also in those videos.
What was the name of the video series again? And we'll put this in our show notes.
The easiest place to find it is frc.org/prepare-to-stand. Good. So Family Research Council set up a webpage that has the videos and a study guide that goes with it. They're free. You can download them for free. You can stream them for free.
Wonderful.
There are seven, and then there's an eighth video where it's my wife and I are basically having a conversation, and you get her input as well.
Yep. We'll put that in our show notes so that everybody can go and learn from that. So thank you so much for making that resource available. You mentioned your wife. I imagine this was a very significant trial for her as well. How did she get through it?
Well, we very much went through it together. And obviously she's on the outside. So very different experience. And she would tell you herself that, she wasn't alone. She had other believers with her. She had our Turkish church with her. And so a very different experience, but we're very close. We're very close friends. Apart from being husband and wife, we did everything together in our ministry. We shared everything. And this was one thing that made it very difficult for me. I really missed my wife. Mm-hmm. And so she suffered. The Lord had a different role for her. So she was fighting to get me out and to spread the word and to, lead prayer and things like that. And she also had the task of, when she was allowed to visit me, and eventually that became a weekly thing where, we're meeting, there's reinforced glass and bars between us and we talk on the phone. But she was eventually allowed to do that once a week, limited period of time. And she would come in and encourage me. And that was a task, to come in and give me words of life and it would keep me going and to speak truth to me, because she'd sometimes have to correct my wrong ways of thinking. So she was really my lifeline.
It sounds like she really ministered to you when you were in the darkness. And
I'd like to give one picture of her, because it's how I see her is, when I was being held at in the first year at a high security prison, so very intimidating place, high walls, guards with machine guns, razor wire, and she would come to visit. And so it's very, as I said, there's the intimidation factor there. For her to get in, she has to go through several security checks where they scan your iris, two different places. It's very high tech, very high security. And then together with that intimidation, you put the shame factor. Not that she was ashamed, but, and the media over there, it was very big in the media across often I was the front page of newspapers, sometimes a whole front page of national newspapers, on TV a lot, as a spy, a terrorist, someone who hates Turks, and just all kinds of slander, terrible things being said to inflame people against Christians. And she's the wife of this terrible spy, agent priest, blah, blah. And she would come into that environment. And as she approached the prison, she would say, "I'm a daughter of the king, and I'm here to see a son of the king." And then she would lift her head up deliberately and walk in with that mentality. And this is the picture I have of her going into this very intimidating, shameful environment, but with the confidence of a daughter of the king.
Wow, that is a beautiful picture. And I think a lot of our listeners are going to be reflecting on that in their mind's eye. What a testament to a biblical, prayerful wife in that season. In addition to her assistance, was there any scripture or particular passages that just really stood out to you or helped you during that time?
So first, remind me to come back to this. Let me give you the realistic take on this. Is when I did not have a Bible, I desperately wanted one. And there were months when I did not have one. And then eventually I was allowed to have it. But the Bible did not take away my pain or my grief or my sense of loss. You know, I still had those. What the Bible did was just having it present in my hands gave me, it was very comforting to me because it kind of represented my faith and history of faith and many who'd gone before me for whom this had been very precious. So it was a physical representation of my faith. So it was very comforting, but the words are not all comforting. There's a lot in the Bible that wasn't very specific to what I was going through. And I would get frustrated reading the Psalms because, you know, David talks about, you know, his oppressors and they usually end, each Psalm ends with deliverance. And I was saying, well, you know, David was always delivered, you know, he was never really caught by his enemies. So yes, he could say, you know, I was in terrible circumstances, God delivered me. And I said, I can't say that. I don't know that God's going to deliver me. And the reality is that there are many people whom God does not deliver in this life. And so it wasn't always, sometimes it was just frustrating, but at the same time, it was a great comfort to me. So one verse that stood out to me was Isaiah 50:10. And my mother had underlined this for me. But God is speaking to Israel in exile, and he says to them, for the one who has no light and walks in darkness, let him trust in the name of the Lord and lean on him. And so God could have said, I'm going to give light, but he didn't. He said, you're going to be in darkness for a while. He left them in darkness. Lean into me. Lean into me in the dark. And so this is what I was trying to do. I felt very much in the dark. You know, even when I took steps and, you know, surrender and all these different things to, you know, to fight for my relationship with God, I thought, well, God, I've learned my lesson now. Now give me your presence. Now give me that sense of grace that will just carry me through like I'm in a bubble. He didn't. So I was in the dark. And basically, I think what God was doing was stripping me of everything, all the ways in which I had experienced his love in the past, the things that had strengthened me, relationships, everything. He stripped me of it. And then it's like, okay, Andrew, are you going to still be faithful to me when you don't see my faithfulness? Are you going to still love me when you don't see my love? And are you going to overcome the offended heart? Because my heart's offended toward God. It's deeply wounded toward him. Are you going to love me and embrace me anyway? And this is something that there are reasons why he was doing this. But it's something I had to learn to do, was to stand in the dark and just lean into him when I can't see anything.
Yeah.
Another verse that became my favorite verse probably is 2 Timothy 4:18. And Paul is in his final imprisonment. This time it's a very miserable imprisonment. And he expects to be executed shortly. And he was executed shortly after he wrote this. It's the last thing he wrote. He says, the Lord will rescue me from every evil deed and bring me safely into his heavenly kingdom. And you have to look at, what does rescue mean? What does safely mean?
Yeah.
He's in a dungeon and he's going to be killed. But he says, God, clearly he didn't expect to be rescued from having his head chopped off.
Right.
Or from his miserable conditions. And I have embraced that verse. I've come to, the way I've come to see it now, what that meant for me was that people often talk to me about, or they send messages about trust, just trust God. When they say that, what they're really saying is trust that God's going to get you out of this. He's going to get you out of prison. And I knew that there's not a verse in the Bible that says Andrew's going to get out of prison.
Yeah.
I think when we come into a context of persecution, that the promises of God are often suspended, at least temporarily, because of what he's doing in the context of persecution. And so the things that we could normally say, this is a promise. Well, yes, but it's suspended right now. And the difficulty I had with the concept of trust, which is very important to God that we trust him, was that it's very hard not to tie it to an outcome. Mm-hmm. And I know we're supposed to trust the person and not the outcome, but it's very hard to separate the two. We're usually trusting for something.
Yeah.
And I had to get my mind and my heart around this, where there are no guarantees of what will happen. I began to think of trust in this way of, I'm going to lean into him.
Yeah.
I'm just leaning into Jesus, and I'm going to trust that he's a good leader. I don't know what he's doing. I don't know what difficulties I'm going to have to go through. I don't know what the results will, you know, what I'm going to have to experience, but what Paul is saying is he's going to take me through to his heavenly kingdom.
Right.
And ultimately that is what most matters. And so I kind of just embrace that and saying, you will take me through to your kingdom.
Right.
And as I look back, I say, I didn't have a sense of grace. I came so close to failing, but I see that he shepherded my heart. He did bring me through.
Yeah. And when you're leaning into passages like that, leaning into God, it also speaks to leaning more into an eternal perspective. Those words make a lot more sense when we think of it eternally rather than our temporal situations. I also think of Philippians 1:21, for to me to live is Christ and to die is gain. That is a perspective that can be challenging when you're in the throes of trials, but if embraced from an eternal perspective, it seems to sync up very clearly. So you certainly went through a lot. How did you come to be released from prison?
Well, there was a lot of political pressure. I think that was a result of many millions of people praying for me. Because as I look now, there's so many things going wrong with the world. So many scandals, so many, you know, terrible things, and over 7 billion people in the world. So how do you get people who are high up to focus for so long on one person? And I'm not an important person. So, you know, I think it was just God mobilizing a lot of prayer and raising my profile for his purposes of bringing that prayer into Turkey. You know, the truth is that the Trump administration, the president himself, was very involved. This is unprecedented for a president to get involved in hostage negotiations. But there were so many people who contacted their friends who could get to the president to keep reminding him. Mm-hmm. You know, Vice President Pence, a strong believer, Mike Pompeo, a strong believer, who kept bringing my case up. And eventually, the U.S. imposed sanctions on Turkey. It led to the collapse of their economy. They already had structural problems, so that was coming. But this is kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. And even then, it didn't lead to my release. But after, on my last trial date, I think probably the pressure had been enough. They convicted me. I'm a convicted terrorist. And
wild.
They sentenced me to prison. Then they released me. Ostensibly to go through an appeals process, but also allowed me to leave the country. And so it was a way of justifying my detention for 2 years. See, he's a terrorist. He's guilty. Now we're letting him go while he goes through the, you know, the appeals process. But it was clearly a political decision. I will say I didn't find out until a year later that the U.S. representatives there in Turkey for my case, who were going to deal with the media once my fourth trial date, once that date was finished, they discussed 4 different scenarios, how they would respond, but not one of them involved my release. Mm. And so I was released very suddenly, and the U.S. government did not expect it. And so I think it was the Lord saying, okay, I've done what I intend to do through this. Now is the end.
Wow. And now you have this incredible experience, as difficult as it was to endure at the time, but it does equip you to speak in ways that others cannot speak, to speak from a perspective that others don't have. Like I introduced this interview, you come with an incredible amount of mature spiritual perspective, mature missional perspective from a tough area, and this perspective of suffering and persecution, which is too rarely known in much of the Western circles of Christendom. And you talked about how your concern is to make sure that others around the world and in the West are prepared. They are becoming prepared. They are able to withstand when a wave of darkness sweeps upon them. But sometimes when we bring that up, that's met with groans. People might disagree. People might think that we're out of line. I think your background challenges that. It pushes back against that because, like I said, you've experienced it, tasted it, and you're still concerned. How do we overcome that? And how do we have pastors? You talk about those that have a stewardship responsibility. How do pastors, how do dads, how do granddads, how do parents address this type of an issue? Why is it so important?
So the first issue is that many pastors do not think that persecution is coming. And so when I talk about this, I think I get various responses. And what I usually try to do is start out by making a case. Actually, pressure is coming. This is where we are now. This is where, you know, some things to look at for the future that are coming our way. And I just think that a lot of people don't think that it's possible. And this is because of, I think, a lack of experience. We have not seen or experienced more intense, you know, I'm not saying we're going to be North Korea or China or Iran. But there is going to be significant pressure, social and financial pressure, and it's going to be enough to knock a lot of people out. But if you don't think it's coming, then you're not going to prepare for it. And so I think the first task is to, I mean, the first thing we need is for people to become aware and to discern the times we're living in. After you do that, then you can begin to take steps. And one of the first steps is to talk about it with people, to make them aware. That persecution is actually something we should expect as believers, that many have gone through it before, and that God will take us through it, but we need to prepare our hearts. We do have a part in it. And then there are a number of other things. I talk about them, especially in the video series, in a very condensed form, so I could hardly begin to do it now. But it's primarily a preparation of the heart. You know, people talk about prepping. No problem with doing practical things if you want to go buy a farm or something. but if you talk to people who've gone through persecution, how do we prepare? The number one thing is going to be preparation of the heart.
And what does that look like?
Well, what can you do, or how do you prepare so that when you're afraid, you do not run but stand? It's not enough to say, well, a real Christian isn't going to be afraid. Well, I've been afraid a lot. And it's very normal to have fear. When you have any threat, the natural response of the body is to want to flee. You know, that's normal. So when I have a threat, the adrenaline increases, my heart starts beating faster. Now, I think what Jesus meant when he says, you know, do not fear, is he's not talking about the emotion of fear as much as saying do not make decisions based on fear. You know, how can we train ourselves, our minds and our hearts, so that when we do have a threat, we choose to stand and not run? One of the big things is the offended heart, which is what almost knocked me out. Jesus warns that the love of many will grow cold. How do we prepare ourselves so that when God doesn't meet our expectations, when we're shocked by what he allows, that we remain faithful to him so that we don't get knocked out by disappointment? Yeah. How about perseverance? How do we build perseverance? You know, that you can begin to build spiritual perseverance now. It's something that we can build now. Yeah. Some very practical steps. How do you guard against deception that's coming? A lot of people will be deceived. And I could talk more about why that would be, the environment we're going into. It has a lot to do with, you know, what many people will call a loving and approving and inclusive church. And I think many people, they're going to be wedge issues. The exclusivity of Jesus and salvation and his demands for obedience from his followers, which include a number of hotly contested issues like life, family, sexual morality, gender identity, biblical justice, family. These are all things that our culture increasingly has unbiblical views on, and God has an opinion on them. And if you are faithful to God's teaching on this, then people are going to say you're unloving, you're hateful. And this is what's going to drive a lot of hostility toward the church. And so how do you keep from being deceived in that environment? There are steps that we can take that are not just learning theology. It's, you know, finding a community of a small community of faithful believers centered on the Word who will stand with you. And I know how important this is because I was alone in prison, physically alone at least. Many prayed for me, but I was alone in that cell. And I know what a difference it makes if we have a family of believers around us, a family of faith that will stand with us. So these are some things that we can begin to do now. And I also think the video series isn't a to-do list, and if you check all the things and you're good. No, it's an introduction into this. And I think that God, for leaders especially, I think God will give you strategies. Now, God will show you how to prepare the sheep, but you've got to be pressing into it. Got to be asking him for those insights and strategies.
And I think you can take baby steps of faith, baby steps of obedience, growing and strengthening yourself as a leader, growing and strengthening as you step out to lead your flock. I think you can take baby steps now to deepen your love and faith in Christ. And when minor challenges start to hit, looking back and reminding yourselves of times of faithfulness where God has been there and provided and carried you, I think we can prepare ourselves just right now to repeatedly remind ourselves that we're going to be slimed. We might be misunderstood. We might be called horrible names, but we know that's not true. Those are lies, and we can be confident in our identity in Christ. And sometimes that means reminding one another in our small local fellowships of the truth of who we really are. And just if you know you're going to be derided, going back to the example of frustration arising when expectations go unmet, if we expect to be called a name and we get called a name, we can move forward. It doesn't take the sting out of it. It doesn't make us blanch a little bit, but we can continue, and it doesn't have the same blindsiding effect that it would if otherwise nobody had prepared us, nobody had warned us, we hadn't thought or processed this through as individual believers and as a church. So I really appreciate the perspective that you're sharing on all of this. I do think you're right. I think you're going to see a demarcation of the church, perhaps to one that's more popular and culturally approved, but deviates from biblical truth, that deviates from the exclusive claims of Christ, and those that are going to be biblical and they're going to remain faithful as the pressures build, and they're going to be derided and not liked. And we just have to be prepared for that. And to, like you said, to stand, not run, but to stand even if we're scared, even if we are a little afraid. Let me just ask you this as we start to wrap up. Do you think that there's a need, as we're thinking through this, these types of conversations, these types of topics that we're touching on, is there a need for Christians to develop a long game mentality? For example, I can see some people saying, okay, I'm going to be faithful, but I think this is all going to be over very quickly, so I can almost just hold my breath and sprint and it'll all be over, versus a Christianity that is thinking in terms still of generations, that's still thinking, how do I leave an example of faith for my grandkids, for my great-grandkids? We don't know when Christ is returning. It could be tomorrow, but it could be a long time down the road. How do I take that step in a long game mindset? I don't hear a lot of conversations about that, but I would be curious what your thoughts would be.
The first thing is, why would we think that it's a short-term thing? If you look at history, you'll see that the freedom, religious freedom we have had, is almost is an outlier in history. The church has often been under pressure. And so I don't know why we think that it would suddenly be different. I have friends who say a revival is coming. There's a big revival coming. In fact, it's already started. And I say, well, I'm hopeful for a big revival too, but before we experience a revival fire, we're going to have a refining fire. And that's what I think is coming on us. I think there is a dark wave that's going to crash onto the church. And I don't think that just because I've read the Bible or my personal fears. I just look at our culture right now. If you look at it, when I went to Turkey in 1993, being a Christian was generally a positive thing. It wasn't, I know not everyone liked it, but it wasn't seen as a very negative thing. It was generally positive, and Christian standards of morality were normative. Not everyone lived up to them, obviously, but that was still sort of the standard. Now, especially in the last 8 to 10 years, something has changed drastically. And now being a Christian is a social negative, especially at the elite levels. Christian morality is publicly repudiated. And so we're at a very different place. Every institution in our country, every institution at the leadership level is hostile to faithful followers of Jesus, especially on those wedge issues that mm-hmm. I mentioned. You take law and medicine, arts, media, entertainment, professional sports, educational system, government bureaucracy, even the top of the military now. I mean, tell me one institution where the leadership looks favorably at faithful followers of Jesus. It's not there. So we're already at a place where our culture is increasingly hostile. Now, look at the future. Gen Z, you know, very high acceptance and identification with the LGBT agenda. Many of them believe that it is that they're justified in silencing those who disagree with them. And a high percentage actually supports violence against those who disagree with them. So if you're seen as evil because you don't support, you know, the LGBT agenda, because you have a different view on family or on marriage or life or justice or whatever, then you're going to be seen as an enemy and someone who causes damage and makes people unsafe. What is it going to happen? So I say, look at the future. Gen Z is young now. What about the millennials? They're rising into leadership. Many of them are not believers. The churches are hemorrhaging people. And so why would you think that it's going to get easier very quickly? The next generations are increasingly hostile to faithful followers of Jesus. That is our future. And so I look at where we are now. I look at what's coming demographically toward us. I think, well, we need to get ready, discern what's coming. Now, I think that there's this dark wave. There's going to be a great exodus from the church for those who don't want to pay the price. But that's going to leave a very refined, beautiful bride. And then we are going to see an influx to the church again from those who are in darkness and are not liking it. But before that happens, we have to survive the wave. So I'm optimistic. I'm pessimistic about our society. I'm optimistic about the kingdom of God. But we need to be sober-minded. A verse that's very much on my heart is Daniel 11:32, where Daniel is speaking to those who will live in very difficult times, and he says, the people who know their God shall stand and take action. And I see this a lot in the church. We're very focused, or accomplish exploits is actually a way of translating it. We're very focused on accomplishing exploits. Let's grow the church. Let's go do more evangelism. Those are all good things. But the wave is coming. It says, those who know their God shall stand. If you don't know your God, you're not going to stand. If you want to stand, know your God. And if you do, then you'll be able to accomplish exploits. Because once the wave hits, if you don't make it through, you're not going to be around spiritually to carry out the assignments God has for you, to be a light in the darkness, to do evangelism. And so I think this is a time especially to focus on preparing ourselves, preparing the sheep, preparing the church, so that we know our God and stand faithfully. And then in the midst of darkness, I'm very assignment driven right now. So like, I pressed into this in prison. God, if this is my assignment, I want to stand before you when I die with no regrets from having left my assignments undone. So I say, God has assignments for us. I know that he's going to move powerfully, even as our society descends into darkness. But we've got to be standing.
Amen. We got to stand. Every one of you is going to have an assignment. They have an assignment right now. And you can go out, you can be that little beam of light, especially in a culture that's increasing in darkness. You're going to reflect, and there's going to be Christians blindsided like we talked about, but there's also going to be a whole lot of other people that aren't paying attention that are going to get blindsided. They're going to get rolled. And like Andrew said, they're not going to like what they're tasting downrange, and they're going to come looking for truth. They're going to see those beams of light. And I do think that he's spot on, that people will come to the church as that wave and after that wave hits. So we all get a part to play. We're going to know rich fellowship with one another. Those that stand together, much like soldiers sitting in a trench together. Those bonds are close. So we do need to be sober-minded. There are going to be plenty of challenges coming ahead, but it's also an exciting time to be a Christian. And it's amazing to think that God has called us to stand in days such as these. So, Andrew, I can't thank you enough for your time. How can our listeners, I will put in the show notes about the Prepare to Stand videos. And you have a book out, I believe it's called God's Hostage. If people want to get more detail on your story while you're in prison in Turkey and other details, are there other ways that our listeners can follow you in your ministry?
We do have a website, it's wavestarters.org, but we don't put our itinerary out for security reasons. I still have security issues.
Well, thank you again for your time. I really appreciate this perspective on behalf of our entire audience, and we wish you the very best in the days ahead. Thank you for joining us today for the Christian Emergency Podcast. If you enjoyed today's show, please subscribe and give us a 5-star review. Also, tell your friends about us and ask them to subscribe as well. To learn more about the Christian Emergency Alliance or financially invest in our ministry, visit us at www.christianemergency.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you again for listening, and stand strong out there.